American Giant makes great clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, and more, right here in the U.S. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, English acting royalty in the form of Jim Broadbent and Penelope Wilton, who talk to me about their new movie, The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, about a man who walks the length of England to try and save his dying friend. We review the much-talked-about horror movie that everyone's raving about, Evil Dead Rise. Plus, theatre director Gary Hines chats about her favourite film. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all. Hope you're doing well. Some nice weather arrived this week. I have been battling a small cold. A very well-known radio host told me, never tell anyone you're sick. No one wants to hear that. I'm only a small bit sick. I just had a cold. Just in case you can hear any nasalness, I seem to have gotten a new summer cold or something, you know. Don't worry, I'm at 90%. And, you know, my 90% is like 250% for a mere mortal. But I knew I was slightly under the weather when I fell asleep on a train this week. You might think that's of no consequence, but I never sleep on public transport. I never sleep anywhere other than a bed. I've, like, crossed the Atlantic in the Indian Ocean and been wide awake in the middle of the night while plane loads of people have been asleep, you know, not plane loads. I was on one plane, but I never sleep on public transport, but I fell asleep on Thursday evening and it terrifies me. I hate, and maybe that's the reason I can't sleep anywhere other than a bed, but I hate being asleep in public, like on a train or something. I'm always afraid I'll have, you know, shouted out something. I'm a good boy, mammy, or, you know, copious amounts of drool or something. But anyway, that's the minutiae of my week. Now, in TV this week, I was watching this.
Right now, dig in. We don't have all day. The rerun of my show starts at 8. Resistance, Sarah, you should watch it. The War of Independence, sure, it's your heritage.
Oh, I will. Oh, I'm so interested in Irish history and literature. Yeah, I really want to visit the Dublin Writers' Museum.
Sure, that's not what you came all this way for, to see where Joyce took a piss once.
Why are you here?
Well, I'm trying to track down some family. I'm looking for my father.
You have an Irish father? God help you.
It's sort of a long story, but
sure, she's Jimmy's daughter.
What?
Yes, Susie. You're dirty, Daddy. Stuck it in an American.
Canadian.
Stuck it in some floozy.
My mother wasn't a floozy.
Is this a joke?
Now that is a clip from Sisters, which is on the RTE player. I think it's still going out on TV every week. Yes, it is on Thursday nights, if I'm not mistaken. But the whole show is up there on the RTE player, all 6 episodes, which are all about 25 minutes. And you heard Susan Stanley and Sarah Goldberg there. You also heard the actress Sophie Thompson playing the mother there. And this was a show in the vein of these messy female shows we seem to be talking about every other week, from Fleabag to Bad Sisters to The Dry, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago. And as I say, it's Sarah Goldberg, who's in HBO's Barry, and Susan Stanley. They wrote this because they're pals and they're also starring in it. And they play two very different half-sisters. Sarah Goldberg's character has just lost her mother. She lives a pretty successful life in Canada, but she's come home because she's found out that she has an Irish daddy. And her Irish daddy is also the daddy of Susan Stanley's character, Suze, there. And there they are meeting at an awkward dinner for the first time. And as I say, the mother is played by Sophie Thompson. And what happens is they reluctantly, and I've watched the whole 6 episodes, they reluctantly go on a road trip to track down their missing father, even though Suze is quite reluctant. Susie's having a bit of a bad time. She's in her mid-30s. Her life is falling apart. Love life is bad. Job is bad. She's drinking too much. Sarah, on the surface, seems like the complete opposite, has it all together. This is funny, and I enjoyed it. Occasionally, there might be elements of stage Irishness, paddywhackery that was maybe courting an audience outside of Ireland. That's possibly being a bit harsh. On the whole, I laughed a lot. Good use of swear words, that they're used effectively. You know, there's a whole art to it, as Billy Connolly says. So it's very sweary, very funny. Plenty of heart in it as well, given the subject matter about trying to connect with people who you haven't in the past. And also doesn't go where you think it might go. There's also a great episode right in the middle of it where they unexpectedly attend a funeral of sorts or a wake. And we've Carrie Crowley in there as well. So all in all, a pretty big thumbs up for Sisters, which is available on the RT player. Well worth a watch. Not to be confused with Bad Sisters, which I suppose has certain similarities. This is Sisters, and very much a two-hander with Susan Stanley and Sarah Goldberg. And Sophie Thompson is great as the mother in there, a fraught mother figure. And Pat Short's in there briefly as well. Now, I should mention, just in case, I don't know if anyone else would know this apart from two or three people, but I've actually known Susie Stanley. She's one of the first people I ever knew. I grew up about four doors from her, and her brother and myself were best pals growing up. Her mother used to babysit me. So just in case anyone texts in going, you know, this is, you're not being honest about this, you're giving this a good review, I have known her a long time. Now, I haven't seen her in a long time also, but she was one of the first people I ever knew, and her brother. So hello to the Stanleys, if they're listening. And nice to see how well Susie's doing in TV. Now, something very different is this.
I'm walking to Berwick-upon-Tweed.
You're what?
I'm going to save Queenie Hennessy.
Have you been drinking?
There was a girl in the garage. She had blue hair. She saved her aunt, she told me.
You can't save people with cancer, not unless you're a surgeon. This is ridiculous. Come home.
It isn't enough to post a letter. Please, I need to do this, Maureen.
Well, if that's what you need, I had no idea.
Walk to Berwick-upon-Tweed.
It can only be about 500 miles.
Now, that was a clip of The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Froy. And you heard Jim Broadbent there talking to Penelope Wilton. Jim is a man well into his 60s who's kind of just seeing out his retirement. Him and his wife, played by Penelope Wilton, are living an uneventful life, and their lives are kind of frozen with each other due to a kind of unspeakable conflict concerning the absence of their son. And then one day he gets a letter saying that his old friend Queenie is dying, and he gets this into his head, having talked to a young girl in a petrol station, as you heard there, that he's going to walk to the hospice she's in, nearly 500 miles away in the north of England. And he begins this, you know, modern day pilgrimage. And along the way, he meets mostly friendly people who come out and support him and take him in. And he walks the English countryside and has quite the journey. And it's a good movie. Great performances by Jim Broadbent and Penelope Wilton. Jim Broadbent is an Oscar winner for his role in Iris. He's been in everything from Indiana Jones movies to Harry Potter to TV. Only Fools and Horses. He played the horrible detective cop Slater. He's a legend, as is Penelope Wilton, who's been in all sorts of things. She was Isabel Crawley in Downton Abbey. She was in Afterlife most recently. I spoke to her last year for Operation Mincemeat. So they are two fine thespians, it's fair to say, who have had long, glittering careers. And I got to talk to them both about The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry. Penelope, if I can start with you, England itself looks lovely in this, and it reminded me a bit of Ireland as well, and English people come across lovely in it as well, because most of the strangers are very kind in this and very human. And I'm not saying that's not the case, I'm not making any political point or anything like that, but I'm wondering, was that part of the attraction of this for you, that it was so wholesome and so Englishly wholesome?
I can't say that was particularly the attraction. I thought it was a very good, very well observed, and indeed that's what
what happens. And the, as has been said many times, the kindness of strangers as to Harold's journey.
Mm.
Of course, Maureen has a far more bleak outlook on life to begin with, which she's cut herself off in that sort of prison of four walls with all those very heavy net curtains and would like the world to go away because she doesn't trust it anymore because of the terrible grief and bitterness she feels. And it's really through Jim's journey and his notoriety and his seeming to manage the outside world that she starts to realize that she can't do without him or has to change.
Mm.
And she does start to change.
Yeah.
So my feelings about the English countryside in this film, as a person, I love and I walk a lot.
Okay.
And but I don't think Maureen has taken that on board.
No, absolutely not. Well, that's a great answer to a question I probably shouldn't have asked you then. Jim, I'm aware that you did the audio book of this, and here you are now doing the role in the movie. You know, I know a gig's a gig and all, but you must really love this character to want to revisit in a movie, having read the entire thing into a microphone.
Yeah, I mean, I've read it three times because you read an audio. You read it to see if you like it, you read it to mark it up, and then you read it to record it. So I knew the character very well. And I did, it occurred to me, if they make a film of this, I'd love to play Harold. Now I know who he is and how it works. So, and luckily they did come my way. But it was an easy decision. I mean, and the idea of bringing him to life and not just reading it off the page was exciting.
Yeah, and was it a help or a hindrance that you'd already read him from cover to cover into a microphone? Because, you know, it's different to play him than to read him, obviously.
It is a good few years between the two.
Yeah.
My memory isn't so good that I remembered every line. it was all familiar enough without being repetitive, if you see what I mean. It came to me fresh in a way.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. And Penelope, you know, the marriage is sad, you know, they're still together, and I don't want to give any spoilers, but it feels like it's been 25 years of just utter bleakness between the two of them, and they've been silent with each other. Did that strike you about it when you read it?
Yes, very much so. I mean, there's something that has thrown them apart.
Mm.
Doesn't seem to be a way back for either of them.
Mm.
They have decided that they found a modus vivendi of how they're going to live, and that's how they're living.
Mm.
But it's not what you would call a marriage. It's called existence and existing with one another.
Yeah.
And they have their separate thoughts and separate bedrooms, indeed.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a difficulty because of this sadness that's happened to them.
Mm.
A lot of blame from her point of view has gone on, and it's you know, grief is a very difficult thing, and it's not always attractive. So it makes you spiky and cross and angry and upset and jagged and vindictive sometimes. And you have to move through those or get rid of them. And Maureen is settled in that sort of state of mind and decided that the outside world is too difficult and too dangerous for her to venture out. So that's where she starts. Of course, she becomes liberated by Harold's journey.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And Jim, you know, there's walking in this, but again, it might be just the illusion of camera, and I don't know what kind of physical shape you're in, but did you have to do a lot of walking for the film?
Yeah, I did a fair amount of walking, but not an excessive amount, because each walk was limited by the length of the shot. So,
yeah. That's what I figured.
Sometimes the shots were quite long, but not that long. But no, some of the junior assistant directors and runners did a lot more running than I did. they had to run to and fro from me or to bring me whatever. When I wasn't filming, I was sitting in a comfy chair, and they were still running around.
Yeah, well, the clue's in the title, The Runners. Jim, can I just ask you, as mentioned before we came on air, not to age you, but I feel like I've been watching your films and TV shows since I was a kid. I spoke to Richard Eyre a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about you and Iris, and your career is large. But I'm wondering, do people like me regularly ask you about a show you were in, I think on only three occasions, called Only Fools and Horses, where you played the wonderful Slater. Do you find people bring that up to you a lot? Because I always think of you, despite the fact that you've done so much more and you've been in these franchises that even my children love, but that's what comes to mind.
Yeah, you're not alone. And particularly in Ireland, actually, when I was filming in Ireland, various people coming. I'm the local Del Boy, you know. Everyone calls me Del Boy. Like, you know. So, but it's gone, and kids who weren't born when we did the last Fools and Horses know it off by heart. It's hugely popular. And one of the things probably the thing I mostly get recognized for.
Wow.
Particularly by cab drivers and
people like me. And you probably only filmed for 3 weeks in your entire career on it.
I did three episodes, yeah. A bit more, because the last two were slightly longer.
Because they were Christmas specials,
sort of thing. So I got, but three jobs over the years. There was a few years between each one as well.
Yeah. Well, listen, lovely to talk to you both. And I should have said at the start, The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry is a delightful film, which I enjoyed immensely. So continued success to you both.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Cheers.
Jim Broadbent there, and Penelope Wilton. Jim Broadbent talking to me about Only Fools and Horses. I had to bring it up. I'm sorry. I know he's, won Oscars, but Only Fools. He didn't seem to mind. And The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry is in cinemas next week, I should say. That's Friday, the 28th of April. Up next, Evil Dead Rise. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. We turn to this week's new cinema releases, and we're going to be looking at Evil Dead Rise, a horror movie that seems to be being close to adored by lots of people, and also something very different, although there are horror elements, a movie called Missing. I'm joined now by film critic and arts journalist Chris Wasser. Chris, how are you?
John, I'm well. How are you?
Not too bad at all. Now, listen, I got a text from someone, the man who was promoting this movie, going, I can't believe you missed this. And I'm kind of bummed that I did, because I'm reading very good things about Evil Dead Rise. Just at the start, to say at the outset, Chris, you have seen this. This is a sequel, the same part of the franchise of the Sam Raimi movies from back in the early 80s.
It is, yeah. And as the posters tell us, it's from the visionary producers of the original, which is to say that Sam Raimi, was an integral part of this getting off the ground. Even Bruce Campbell was involved. And it's the fifth film in the Evil Dead saga. There's no real kind of, there's no real straight line here. And there's nothing to suggest that it's a sequel to the last one that was out, which actually wasn't directed by Sam Raimi, or whether it's a standalone sequel to the original trilogy. In other words, John, I'm not really sure where it stands in the whole setup.
Yeah.
But it's an Evil Dead film. There are Evil Dead people. There are, kids running for their lives. It's the same sort of setup.
Yeah. Basically. And if a person, I'm not sure how much of a horror fan you are. I'm not a huge one. But if a person is a massive horror fan, the first and possibly the second Evil Dead movies by Sam Raimi are kind of classics of the genre, it's fair to say, and they tend to be adored, right?
Oh, they really are, yeah, and genuinely terrifying too. The first one made for very little money, the second one had a little bit more behind us, but the first Evil Dead film is genuinely terrifying, as I said, but the second one kind of adapts this sense of humor that I don't think anybody saw coming, and it was a perfect blend of comedy and horror. I mean, the Evil Dead films are sometimes seen as comedy horrors,
yeah.
But the first one was, kind of played it a little straighter. The third one, Army of Darkness, went absolutely bananas using this kind of time travel storyline that Sam Raimi originally had in mind for the second. These things don't really follow any rules, but a few things that we've come to get used to are, the chainsaw elements, Ash just being, his groovy self, terrifying happenings with, flesh-possessing demons, and that sense of humor. So these are all the things that we're looking for going into Lee Cronin's one, because, this is the big selling point, especially from an Irish perspective, is that, Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell have essentially handed the keys to this universe to a filmmaker from Scary
Stuff. Yes, who gave us A Hole in the Ground, which is a great horror movie from, it's probably nearly 10 years ago. Well, maybe not 10 years ago, but it's a good few years ago at this stage. Okay, so let's get to this. So no necessarily a through line in terms of story from the first one, but very much some of the same motifs going on. So what's actually happening plot-wise in this one?
Well, I'm actually glad to see that Lee Cronin has decided to shake things up a little bit, and that is to you know, to relocate the horror from a countryside cabin to this, you know, decrepit urban apartment block. He does kind of, you know, set the beginning of the film at a cabin, at a lakeside retreat, and then, you know, takes us back a day or two. You know, there's always a bit of carnage at the beginning, but then, oh, what happened before this carnage? But it's a contemporary story. It involves a family. It involves a couple of estranged sisters who haven't really been a part of one another. There's lies for the past year or two, but we're in this apartment block where, you know, we're following Beth and Ellie. Beth is a guitar technician. She follows rock bands around the world. She hasn't really talked to her sister Ellie, played by Lisa Sutherland. Beth is played by Lily Sullivan. Then you've got Lisa Sutherland as Ellie, and they haven't really talked to one another in a while. But Beth shows up on Ellie's doorstep because she is pregnant and she is wondering whether or not to keep the baby, and she needs, you know, the advice of her elder sister, who already has three kids. And she shows up on the same night that an earthquake hits Los Angeles, opens up this hole in the car park underneath the family's apartment block. And of course, you have three teenagers in the family. So the teenagers approach this hole in the ground and they look inside. And of course, they find, you know, a haunted, malignant text. And usually in the Evil Dead films, you also have a recording or a tape. But in this case, it's a vinyl. So obviously, these are curious teenagers. They bring it up to the bedroom. They play the vinyl. And then that's when things get gory. Basically, the mother is possessed by this, you know, flesh-possessing demon. And it's up to the sister then to protect the kids at all costs, but they can't make it out of the apartment because when the earthquake happened, the staircase fell in. So they're stuck in this apartment. There's a haunted mom on the loose. Chaos ensues.
Aha. And is there, not to jump ahead, but is there some allegory or metaphor here about the fear of childbirth or something like that? Because you mentioned she's deciding whether to keep a child or not.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, you could see some of these elements at play in The Hole in the Ground, which of course starred Shauna Kerslake as a single mother raising this child sort of in the middle of nowhere in Ireland and struggling. You know, it's one of those kind of, if the kid is evil and if the parents are struggling, then of course there's some sort of allegory at play here. And in Evil Dead Rise, we see Beth, you know, she's come home. She doesn't know what to do. She's thinking of her career, but she's also thinking, you know, do I want this kid? And she's come to get the advice from her sister, but her sister can't quite, you know, give her the advice that she wants because her marriage at the same time is breaking down. So you've got this really tense family reunion. You've got an awful lot going on underneath the surface there. But once the aunt starts taking care of the kids because the mom is possessed and, you know, you see all of this carnage, you know, comes to light, you are thinking to yourself, well, okay, Lee Cronin is definitely trying to, you know, he has this, you know, family drama playing out underneath the horror, but it is all about the horror. And once the, you know, once the possession starts, it's just bananas, John. Now, in the best possible way, because I should say, we've seen a few horrors so far this year. Not many, you know, there have been fewer than maybe other years, but this is probably the most scared that I've been in a cinema this year. So that's a good thing for a start. You know, it's not just relying on cheap jump scares or it's not just relying on old tricks to get our heart racing. You know, there is a genuine build up to the first bit of horror. So once we actually get there, it's like, okay, Lee, you've earned this. Let's go. So it is quite effective.
Yeah. So from the reviews I've read, they've said the same kind of thing. This is genuinely scary. So it takes you up to a point, then starts to scare you and continues to relentlessly scare you kind of up until the end, or...
I think so. I think one of the best aspects of this film is that it just barely passes the 90-minute mark. Mm-hmm. That makes for a great horror. Most horrors, they just can't keep, you know, the scares intact after 2 hours. And I think, you know, look, it does work. This is certainly, it's probably the most blood that I've ever seen in an Evil Dead film. The amount of fake blood in here is unbelievable. And Cronin is having his fun sort of tipping his hat to the original Sam Raimi production, but also other horror pictures. You know, there's a little bit of, at times I thought there was a little bit of The Babadook at play. I thought there was a little bit, you know, of he's maybe looking at what the Conjuring universe has done a little bit, you know, the better Conjuring installments, that is. And also there's a very obvious Stanley Kubrick Shining tip of the hat in there too. I won't spoil what that involves, but it does, you know, there is a lot of blood, let's say. But I think the horror works, the drama works, it's very well performed, it is effective. If I have a quibble, it is a minor one, and that's sometimes I wanted Cronin to just crack open the window and bring in the humor that this franchise is famous for. It would have just given, you know, it would have just allowed us to take a breath, because even though it is only 90-odd minutes, I felt that sometimes that we just needed a bit of a break. And it's a shame too, because these films, especially from the second one, they are famous for having a very goofy, playful sense of humor. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'll give out to myself for saying that, because maybe it is nice that Lee Cronin is doing his own thing, you know? And also I've heard from people that have watched it a couple of times that, you know, you can actually spot some of the, you know, very subtle comedy on a second viewing. Now, I don't know if I'll be brave enough for a second viewing just yet, but Cronin does his own thing. This series hasn't always delivered the goods. You know, I mentioned earlier Army of Darkness. Yeah. Army of Darkness is probably not as good as it thinks it is. I wasn't crazy about the last reboot that we got. Yeah. I think this is one of the good ones.
Yeah, and I mean, that's high praise indeed, that people are starting to rewatch it already and see what they might have missed the first time and see if they can find humor in it. Tell me this, in terms of the gore and all that, there's a high gore rate as well.
Oh, there is, yeah. You know, as I said, there's a lot of blood, so obviously there's a lot of gore, but at one stage a character has their scalp ripped off, which is, you know, it's an interesting thing to see at a Tuesday morning press show, John. yes. There is an awful lot of killing going on. There's an awful lot of freaky voices. Everyone will know by now the bit from the trailer where the mother tells her kids that mommy's with the maggots now. That, yeah, for me was the freakiest thing. It is quite imaginative with its gore, I will say that. That, you know, gory horror has never been my favorite. But, you know, if you're going to have a little bit of fun with it, as Lee Cronin does in this, that's fair enough. So it is genuinely terrifying. It is quite claustrophobic. I mean, this idea again that it's sort of a haunted house thriller or horror in that apartment block, you know, they can't leave, there's no way out, you know, they're on the top floor, so he does, you know, there is a lot of fun to be had within those four walls. So it is quite effective in terms of the gore and in terms of the scares.
Yeah, no, I've just seen the trailer and a couple of clips, and that scene where the mother talks about, or that character talks about mother being with the maggots in that horrible voice, genuinely scary. And just for, I don't know why, but did remind me slightly of Linda Blair when her voice changes in The Exorcist,
yes,
all those years ago. So it sounds like Lee Cronin was having fun, but also made a pretty fine film. So what are you going to say stars-wise for Evil Dead Rise?
I think so. I think this film does what it's supposed to, and it does it very well. And I'd really like to see Lee Cronin. I mean, he's done something original with the Evil Dead films. I mean, even just taking it out of the countryside as well, that gives it a bit of originality. I'll say what I said once after I had seen The Hole in the Ground. I'm looking forward to seeing what he does next. I want to see an original story, something that doesn't involve, you know, a saga that's already there. If he gets to make another one, okay, I trust that he would do something fresh with it again. But I want to see an original horror now from Lee Cronin. So he's a great director. This film is very effective, does what it's supposed to. I'll give it 4 stars out of 5.
4 stars. Excellent. So that's 4 stars for Evil Dead Rise. Let's take a quick clip.
Who's your friend, Cass?
She's called Stephanie.
Oh. Hey, Stephanie. What's her situation?
Danny told me that when this building used to be a bank, a teller got caught stealing and hanged himself. And if you walk around with coins in your pockets, his ghost hears the jingle. And he scares you to death so he can take all your money.
It's true.
If he comes after me, Stephanie will scare him to death first.
Ghosts aren't real.
Have you ever seen one?
Mm-mm.
Then how do you know they don't exist?
Because I only believe what I can see.
That's a clip there from Evil Dead Rise, which I should say is in cinemas from this weekend, the 21st of April. And Chris Wasser, who I'm talking to, gave it 4 stars, and it scared him because he's a bit of a scaredy cat by all accounts. So another movie we're going to review quickly is Missing, which seems to largely take place on a variety of screens, if I understand it correctly, Chris.
Yeah, that's it. It's called these films are called Screen Life films. Did you know that?
No, Screen Life films.
Screen Life, yeah. Okay. And I think the makers of this and other films like Unfriended, you might remember Unfriended, The Dark Web. I think all of these filmmakers who set their films on someone's laptop. I think they've sorely overestimated the audience's interest in that particular genre. It's like the weird cousin of the found footage genre, where all of the events you're watching in the film play out on a laptop or a smartphone or some sort of device where, you know, the characters are literally looking at us. It's almost like we are the camera. It's a very peculiar genre.
Did see one, sorry to interrupt you, a couple of years ago called Spiral or Spree, I think it was. No, it was Spiral with the kid from Stranger Things, and that largely takes place on a guy filming in a taxi. It wasn't bad, actually, but it does become quite intense after a while where you're just watching this stuff. But anyway, battle on, Chris.
Yeah, this one is actually, it does become very intense after an hour, and this almost gets to the 2 hour mark, so that's one big flaw. But this is actually a standalone sequel to Searching, which is to say that this film, Searching, from 5 years ago, it was about a father looking for his missing daughter and using her devices and all of her apps to try and find her. So although this is set in the same world, it doesn't feature any of the same characters, because that would just be ridiculous. That would be a Home Alone 2 job. This sort of thing can't happen to the same family again. But what we have is an 18-year-old named June, portrayed by Storm Reid, who's very good here, and she is annoyed at her mum because her mum Grace, played by Nia Long, seems to have moved on from her dad. So her dad died when she was little. She's now 18, but she's still annoyed that Grace has a new boyfriend. She has a new boyfriend, Kevin, played by Ken Leung, and they're off to Colombia. So it's the typical thing. She doesn't say goodbye properly to the parent before they go on holiday. Of course, you know something bad's going to happen. So while she's off partying with her friends in the house for a week, she fully expects them to come home after 7 days. They don't, and she does notice a couple of things that might suggest there was some foul play involved. So the longer that she's away, an investigation starts by the police, but of course the police, according to, you know, this teenager, they're not doing their job properly, so she's gonna have to don her digital detective hat.
And then again, I didn't see this, but from the trailer there's a intimation that all is not what it seems, and there may be more to her mother, and certainly her boyfriend's mother.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that it's kind
of her mother's boyfriend, I should say.
Yeah, it's a mystery piled on top of another mystery, and the film just full of probably too many mysteries. But the gist of it is that, you know, this teenager is essentially going to sit in her bedroom or a sitting room and, you know, hack into the boyfriend's Gmail, hack into her mom's, all of their social media. She even kind of, you know, befriends this this cleaner in Colombia who she FaceTimes and gets to kind of check out all of the shops and all of the restaurants and places that the couple was in Colombia, just to see if there's any sort of record of them, because they seem to have vanished from the hotel. So you kind of have to, you know, it does... you kind of have to leave your brain at the door for some of this, because you will be asking too many questions about how on earth could a teenager do this. But at the same time, while I was thinking it was quite far-fetched, I think probably the more far-fetched aspect is that the filmmakers think that we're going to sit here for 2 hours without checking our own phones or without checking our watches, because it's an awful lot to ask the audience to basically sit there and stare at all of these different apps and all of these different screen time sessions and all of these different digital, you know, oddities, and not, you know, start to lose your mind. So for the first hour, I was sitting there thinking, okay, well, this is actually quite fun, and I'm enjoying trying to solve this mystery. And the film also establishes a sort of rule book, which is to say that all of the action can only take place inside, you know, if the camera is on these people. And then in the second hour, I found it just abandoned that, and it starts doing things that you're like, well, how come there's a camera there? How come, who's editing this? You know, I think I was maybe asking too many questions because I was sitting there too long, John.
So the central conceit of it all being taking place on various, like a FaceTime or a Gmail account that you're looking through, does it change after an hour, or it just gets so laborious you start to get annoyed by it?
A little bit of both. It just gets a little bit laborious, and you start to kind of think, okay, well, I just need to see, you know, real people interacting.
Yeah.
I need to escape from this computer. But there are just a few too many twists and turns, and it also kind of spoils itself a little bit. You know, it wants the audience it wants you to think that, you know, the film is always a step ahead of you, but we were actually, you know, I was speaking to people afterward, and a lot of people seem to be two or three steps ahead of it. So it's not as clever as it thinks it is, but I will say there are some nice ideas. This could make, you know, I think this genre of film it could work for short stories. It could work for, you know, an anthology series where you're only doing something like 40 minutes of it at a time. And there are some lovely performances in there too. As I said, Storm Reid, who I last saw in, I think it was maybe A Wrinkle of Time, that Disney film with Oprah and Reese Witherspoon, at the time, which was a bit of a disaster. But again, nice performances. And she is quite good here. It's just a bit too much of it. And also just the plot goes absolutely bananas in the final 20 minutes and kind of spoils itself. And as I said, it starts doing all of these things where you're thinking, how come there's a camera set up over there? And I shouldn't hear this. I shouldn't be able to see what's happening there. It kind of breaks its own rules, which is a shame.
Yeah. It sounds like it loses its own logic, as you say. Okay. And sorry, that movie I was trying to think of was Spree. That's what I was
going. Okay.
Not Spiral. Spiral is a horror movie with Chris Rock. Yes. But anyway, so it sounds like this is maybe trying to be too clever for its own good. So what are you going to say stars-wise for Missing?
Yeah, I think it's perfectly fine until it isn't. It just lost me in
like
that
a lot of things in life. Yeah. Right?
I think it just lost me in that last half hour. But look, it's good fun for an hour or so. I think there could be a future for this genre, as I say, in anthology series or in short films. But 111 minutes of this stuff, John, it's too much. So I'll go with the 3 stars, and I'll just say, just approach this one with caution.
Okay. You know, you were, of course, on the show 2 weeks ago with Aoife Barry talking about your favorite comedies, and you made the point 90 minutes for any comedy. You really like movies across genres to be a tight 90 to 2 hours, don't you? I'm sensing that.
I think I do. I think I make the exception for someone like Scorsese. And the reason I mention him is I've just been reading that, you know, his new one, Killers of the Flower Moon, is going to clock in at an official runtime of 3.5 hours. And when I see that, I go, well, do you know what? We only get Scorsese every few years.
Yeah.
I'm happy to give over an afternoon / early evening to Scorsese. And in some science fiction stories, 2 hours is worth it. But if you're making comedies, horrors, little thrillers like this that rely on, you know, trying to stay, as I said, one step ahead of the audience because it's a mystery. You've got a very short time to do that, I think, that in order to make it effective. So 90 minutes, you know, 100, that's the cutoff point.
Yeah, fair enough. The man, he speaks great sense there, I have to say. So that is 3 stars for Missing, which is also on general release from this Friday, the 21st of April. And Chris Wasser gives it 3 stars. Chris, thanks a million.
Thanks, John.
Chris Wasser there chatting to me about Evil Dead Rise and latterly Missing, which are both in cinemas from this weekend. Up next, theatre director Gary Hines chats about her favourite film. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. It's that stage of the week where we talk to someone well known about their favourite movie. I'm delighted to be joined now by Gary Hines, artistic director and co-founder of the famed Druid Theatre Company. Gary, hi, how are you?
I'm very well, John. How are you?
Very well. So I was saying to you before we came on air, I've been doing this show 4 years, and surprisingly, no one has ever chosen this classic of modern cinema. So will you tell our listeners what it is and why?
Well, it's from the original novel, Dr. Zhivago, and it was made into a film, which was released, I think, probably about the mid-60s. And it's basically the story of a number of characters caught up in the revolution and the revolutionary events of Russia. And it goes through their entire life. So it's an epic film, and it's still probably one of the biggest films I've ever seen. And it left a huge impact on me. I think I was a teenager when I saw it. I remember the cinema I saw it in Galway, which is no longer there. And I remember the feeling and the images of it. I think it appealed to my sense of a big story and my sense of the lives of a lot of characters being caught up in events that now are not necessarily of their making. And of course, that's what I'm about to head into myself with the O'Casey trilogy.
So in terms of Dr. Zhivago, it's a sprawling epic. It's over 3 hours, if memory serves. Do you think it was the romance of it or the sheer power of the storytelling that struck this young 18-year-old or whatever you were at the time?
Oh, I think probably the romance of it for certain. And I mean, like the sense of a love that is never to be but will never die, I think that definitely went straight into my heart. But then also, as I said, a sense of great events and great continents. And there was nothing small or domestic about it. It was huge. And I think that appealed to me.
And the two standouts, I mean, there are many actors in it, from Tom Courtney to all sorts of people, but Omar Sharif as the dashing lead, and also the beautiful. If we're still allowed to say beautiful about people, I'm not sure, I get confused. But to
you're
my
allowed
mind,
to say it about, if you're not allowed to say beautiful about Judy Christie, then certainly has ended as far as
Exactly. So the beautiful Julie Christie there, and I've only seen it once, and it's a long time ago at this stage, but their interactions are beautiful and tragic.
Absolutely. And you know, I can remember when he's sort of traveled through the snow and the snow blindness in his eyes and the redness around his eyes and everything. You just want to go up and just, you know, sort of feed him sips of brandy until he recovers in your arms. I mean, he's, you know, he remains then, of course, the epitome of romance, and still is since then.
Yeah. And he's the character he plays. He's a doctor, obviously, and he's also a poet, right?
And he's also a poet. Yeah. And again, it was that sense of those two things, the poetic side, but the fact that he helped people and sort of made them well, you know, the I suppose you could say nearly all human life was there in a way.
Yeah, it certainly was. And I suppose it's maybe a hackneyed question, but I mean, this was taking place in a revolution in Russia around 1917 and Lenin coming to power, and then the Civil War when some people didn't want that or whatever. Are there parallels to what's going on in that part of the world today, or that close part of the world? Or maybe there aren't.
Well, I mean, of course there are in some senses, you know, but I mean, you'd like to think that back then it was a fight for revolution and for, you know, you weren't aware of the subtleties on it, whereas the sheer barbarity, well, the sheer barbarity of what happened then too. I suppose one of the things that strikes me is that, you know, having been born within a few years of the end of the Second World War, I never thought to see a war like the current war in Ukraine. I thought that was part of the past. To see it happening all over again is extraordinarily depressing, I think.
And tell me this, is Dr. Zhivago a movie you watch regularly, or is it one that's just, I don't know, you know, calcified in your collective?
It's memory? One that's calcified, I think. I don't, I have watched it since. I've watched it maybe two, three times since, you know, to watch it on better screens and so on.
Yes.
But I think it's more the impression that it made on me then than it is frequent rewatching.
Yeah, sure. Well, look, it's a fine choice and a classic with a capital C. Now, you mentioned there your own upcoming magnum opus, which is Druid O'Casey. So for people who don't know, it's going to be Juno and the Paycock, The Plough and the Stars, Shadow of a Gunman. People will go to the theater and see the three plays performed in one day.
That's right. Well, they have a choice. They can either see the three plays performed in one day, starting at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and finishing at the usual time of around 10:30, or they can see each individual play on three consecutive evenings. But the way I would see them is to see all three together. And indeed, that's the way the audiences seem to be wanting to see them at this stage, because almost all our Trilogy Day performances are sold out. So in Galway, and then they're almost sold out in Dublin. So, you know, we've been doing this now for the last 20 years or so. And I think there's something... they seem to appeal to audiences, I think, for lots of reasons. First of all, they have to obviously entertain you and be good plays, and you can only discover that when you go into the theatre. But I think they also appeal as a sense of event. I think an audience develop a closeness with one another and develop a kind of a stronger bond as an audience than they do in a shorter time, and the stories of friendships being struck up at one of these events or whatever. So, yeah, But in particular, for us with these three plays now, I mean, they were written over a period of 5 years, one after the other. They were written by a writer who was writing the plays within a few years of the events which form the background to the plays. The 1916 Rising, the War of Independence, and the Civil War. I mean, what an extraordinary thing that O'Casey had such a place, such a viewpoint on these plays, and that then he turned and wrote these plays, and the Abbey produced them. So all three plays were done within 4 years of each other.
Yeah. It's an incredible achievement.
It's an incredible achievement. And of course, it was very much the saving at the Abbey at the time, because financially things were very, very difficult. And these plays were what we would call nowadays instant hits, you know?
Yeah.
They proved hugely popular and packed out the theatre, as they've continued to do in the Abbey and many other theatres throughout the world since then.
Yeah, you kind of made allusion to people going and kind of discovering them in the dark there with people around them. You know, on this show, in terms of the cinema, we talk a lot about the changes in cinema. Some people even talk about the death of cinema because of streaming and all those things. And particularly we talked about that during the pandemic. But I was wondering, and of course, during the pandemic, theatres experimented with, you know, remote recordings and virtual things. But is there something, and it's a very big question, I understand, but is there something unchangeable about theatre, that it's not open to the same vagaries that maybe cinema and movie watching is? Because no matter what happens, it seems to me, but I'd love your opinion on it, that there's an elementalness to the theatre in that it has to be people on a stage and people in an audience, and that in a way, that's never going to change. So it has a strength that's going to keep it alive. But what's your sense of that?
Well, my sense of it is exactly as you describe it. You know, theatre has to have a couple of essential things. It has to have at least one actor speaking and or being, and at least one actor watching that other actor being. And without that, you cannot have theatre. So a rehearsal room is not theatre. Theatre can't exist until the audience come into the space and help make it theatre. Mm-hmm. In that sense, that's why it's a terribly expensive art form. But that's why, at its very, very best, why it's so special, because it's you know, you will never replicate again what you get.
Yeah.
It's why theatre performance can vary from evening to evening or day to day.
Yeah.
No one audience is ever the same, and so therefore no one performance is ever exactly the same as another performance.
And in a kind of related question, I was talking to Paddy Branock, the film director, two weeks ago on this show, and he was talking about how in the 90s, when he was starting off, there was very little received wisdom. Like, in a way, being a film director when he started was a bit like being an astronaut in the 50s, you know, and he was talking about how now he goes into colleges and all that kind of stuff. But I was wondering, when you started out, Is the analogy the same, or is it completely different? Because we do have a rich heritage of making plays in Ireland. We're talking about O'Casey and Yeats and the Abbey and all those things. So does it seem like less a wild thing to start than maybe going into the cinema back in the
70s? No, it seems perfect. It seems perfect. I wish I'd thought that, because that's exactly what it was for us as well, in the sense of, like, for instance, I'm not sure I had ever seen a professional play before we founded a theatre called the Professional Theatre Company of Galway. And it was, you know, my knowledge of plays was the amateur movements, thank God for it. And that's where I cut my teeth. So when we were doing... when we did something like Playboy, none of us had ever seen Playboy before. And so we were kind of, we were in a Garden of Eden situation, I think. And I, you know, on reflection, that was very good for us.
Yeah, yeah, okay. And then just finally then, so if you said some of these day-long performances are sold out, but for the few remaining tickets that are left for Druid O'Casey, which is going to be in Galway, Belfast and Dublin, of course, yes. In the Lyric and the Abbey, people can go to druid.ie, is that it? And
that's
all
right.
Sorts druid, of other places.
Druid, and druid.ie are on the in the Lyric or on the Abbey websites, any of the three. And obviously the Galway Arts Festival Town Hall Theatre. So because we're the very first performances of it will take place during the Galway Arts Festival.
Yes, and so they're in Galway in July, Belfast in August, and the end of August in the Abbey Theatre. Gary, I was going to call you the Grand Dame of Irish Theatre, but that might age you terribly, so I won't do
Absolutely.
That.
Oh, I've already aged myself by picking Dr. Zhivago as my favourite film. Anyhow, go ahead.
Not at all. And if you do want to find out more about Druid O'Casey, you can go to the various websites that Gary just mentioned. Her favourite movie is Dr. Zhivago. Gary Hines, thank you so much for chatting to me.
Thanks a million, John.
Who sent you here, Zhivago?
No one sent me here, Commander. I'm going to Uryatin with my wife and child. They're on the train from Moscow.
Yes, we've checked that.
Then?
You put your knife with a fork and a spoon and it looks quite innocuous. Perhaps you travel with a wife and child for the same reason.
No.
Uryatin is occupied by white guards. Is that why you're going there?
No. We're going on to Varikino.
Not through Uryatin, it's under shell fire.
Commander, I'm not a white agent.
A clip there from Dr. Zhivago, the favourite movie of Gary Hines, the co-founder and artistic director of Druid Theatre Company. And full details of those various O'Casey in a Day shows can all be found on druid.ie. That is it for this week. My thanks to Anne-Marie Kane, who helped out on the show. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage, you can email me screentime@newstalk.com or you can tweet me John_Fardy. Thank you for listening. Have a safe week ahead and I'll talk to you next week.